From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 719, How Black Hats Profit, with guest Paula Yanishevitz, recorded Monday, July 20th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is a regular. It's Paula Yanishevitz. I think I got that right the first time today. Is that right?
I think it's great. I think it's perfect. Thank you so much.
I think it's pretty close. It's only been like 12 years, Paul. I mean, you should eventually learn how to pronounce your name.
It's very complex. And every time like I go abroad, it's this.
It's very Polish. Well, and the Anglican spelling is not phonetic. Let's say it that way, right? I mean, that's always a challenge with Polish words.
Right, right. So the J-A, it's not ja, but it's ja, and a couple of more vowels over there.
Yeah. How are you?
Well, it's all good. It's very interesting time we live in right now because of the COVID situation, especially from cybersecurity perspective. But besides that, all good. Thank you. And you?
I'm doing all right and certainly making lots of shows. I've been doing a separate series specifically on pandemic topics, although I didn't want to focus on that with you today, but it's always good to just check in. I mean, we've been friends a long time as well. We've been talking about the impacts in cybersecurity around the pandemic, but and it's like it's not like there's more bad guys. It's that they're just targeting the fears around the pandemic. I don't know if you've seen the same sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny fact as well is that there is actually a global risks report that has been released, and this one says that the second biggest threat right now in the world, it's actually after, of course, things like flooding and different nature-related problems, it is actually cybersecurity.
Wow. So cybersecurity is getting outside of the tech field of a major risk into just the regular world now recognizes that cybersecurity is a huge risk.
Yes, it is a huge risk. And there were also, in general, cyber attacks given as an example, and also data or in general, fraud.
Right. So theft via deception, whatever that may be. Interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
So again, this is no longer an edge case. This is normal thinking about your digital security, not just from a business perspective, but a personal perspective, because it's becoming a dominant force in the world when it comes to bad guys anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we also noticed, even though we've got an interesting time right now. Cybersecurity definitely was like a number one subject for us too, because economically or business-wise, we can totally see the increase in different types of cybersecurity services that we deliver to our customers.
Yeah, I bet. And well, when we're recording this, our friend Troy Hunt is loading a 11 billion record breach.
That's really cool. That is absolutely cool.
Well, I said this to my wife, and she's like, are there 11 billion email addresses? Because there's only 7 billion people. And I'm like, yeah, this might be all of them and their passwords.
So, especially with the passwords, yes, because that's another interesting subject over here. I thought that in 2020, I hoped that people won't be actually storing passwords in that reversible way.
Yeah.
Not to mention the clear text in databases, right?
Yeah. I mean, you would hope, but I don't think it's the case. I suspect this 11 billion, whatever it is, and I'm sure I'll find a link to have I been pwned about it, is an aggregate, is somebody scraping together all the lists and consolidating them to show this huge level, of numbers. It's crazy. And I appreciate that Have I Been Pwned now provides a service for us where you can easily check passwords off against their system to say, hey, this password's already been exploited. Like, you really shouldn't use it.
Absolutely. That's one thing. But the second thing also that comes over here is the case of a password reuse.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be thinking, okay, that's bad, and we could feel threatened by this and so on. But on the other hand, if we use different passwords for various services, it's not really our fault that from the user perspective, of course, that certain service has been hacked. That means someone did not do a good job over there, apparently. But on the other hand, even though our password leaks, that should not be a problem for us, right? So yeah. There should be only a problem with that service. But any other services that we use passwords for, they have just simply different passwords.
Well, and my sense is that there's a non-trivial number of people on that listen to this show that are in IT that are using password managers and do have different passwords everywhere. But the people that they support are not using them.
Right, right. So that's the classic situation, right?
Yeah.
And not really long time ago, one of my colleagues' situation was that her Facebook account has been accessed. We tend to say hacked in general, but I really don't like to even say that because it's not that Facebook has a problem. She had a problem because her password was simple.
Right.
Or eventually she did something that managed to eventually extract password
compromise
that she was
it.
Possibly storing somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a Facebook problem.
It was a reused password somewhere. Somebody got a list. They were running down that email password combination and opened her account. And I love that you don't want to use the word hack because it was that complicated. It was a little piece of software that was running down a list of emails and password combinations, trying Facebook logins, and one of them worked.
And that's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So their yeah, login absolutely. Was not all that much different than her logging into her account.
And she was apparently an easy target. And then someone was actually using her mailbox to send emails to people that she was like corresponding with. And another thing was that under her name, this person was sending requests to borrow, let's say, $500. Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's like asking friends to borrow $500. Nice one.
All right. Nice one, right?
Yeah.
And she told me that like her colleague actually approached her and asked her about it. And she was like, yeah, I will do this for you, no problem, but give me a little bit of time or something like that. And
she's
was like,
what?
You do what for me? Because she didn't really realize that was actually happening behind her back.
Yeah. Wild. And such a great social engineering. You know, and there's all the variations on that. Hey, I'm in a faraway land and I've been robbed and can you send me $1,000? Like
that kind of stuff.
The sort of thing I would do for a friend too, but of course nobody's traveling right now. So that's not a good, you know, a good scam, but yeah.
But you know, that could be a good excuse too, right? Because mm-hmm. it could be more of I'm in a like difficult situation because I lost my job because of pandemic.
Right.
And here we go.
Yep. Now we're back to that social engineering side of things as well. Yeah. Very,
right.
very, mm-hmm. very straightforward, simple person-to-person hacking. Are there tools that make it easier? Like, I can't imagine that this is being done at scale by hand, that this is just an individual who figures each one of these things out. Like they're using software for it, right? It's not that complex. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the Metasploits of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got automation tools that can help you out mm-hmm. to do that, especially to do the password spraying for these kinds of accounts. And then when you've got a successful login, you've got a prompt, you've got a statement somewhere. It depends on a tool. And then maybe the rest could be like done manually. It depends really on the who is actually doing this.
Right.
But eventually, even though like it's automated or not, it's equally dangerous. You just earn less money from the hacker perspective.
Right. Because it takes more effort.
Right.
But in the end, you know, for the most part, this is hacking that is trying to be profitable. Like this is not the old days where we built worms as experiments and they got out of control and oops, sorry, no payload. This is people trying to live off of convincing people to give them money by impersonating others.
Yeah, and unfortunately it works. Yeah. And if we take statistics into considerations, there were like some stats that were confirming that the person with a successful ransomware campaign can earn like approximately $99,000 per month.
Wow.
That's a pretty good salary for...
That's a lot. It's
writing a piece of code. Yeah, it is a lot.
Well, and a lot of this code is off the shelf too. Like it already exists. You just have to put it together and create a decent campaign. And, you know, you'd think if they were that disciplined, that they would be a white hat, not a black hat.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's quite an interesting approach too. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, these things are usually underneath very simple. So it's just like one idea that you drop in and it works. And if it works for, let's say, 100 people, you've got already a really nice boost of cash when it takes to earning money illegally.
Right. It is a crime you're committing here. And depending on where you're committing it, you can be arrested for it. So, you know, you might want to call it the business of hacking, but it's not really a business. It's still just criminal activity. And you can get charged, and that can significantly change your life.
Mm, absolutely. But it's usually quite hard to find. So in general, in our team, we do participate in such cases to try to trace back whether it's possible or not, or figure out at least the logic that stands behind, so that you can design a good protection method.
Right.
But on the top of that, not every case obviously can be solved. Some of the cases, they actually manage to get to some point to court. And we've been participating actually. This has been a couple of years ago in a very interesting case where the guy was actually captured, and our job was to objectively analyze, how else but saying, the evidence that was gathered by FBI. And that has been a very interesting case.
So you're acting as the expert and providing
subject matter. Absolutely. And that was quite interesting because we were also comparing our results, our research, with that research that at the time FBI did. And there were a couple of differences. And eventually, what happened is that this guy was imprisoned to the time of a case in a court. Yeah, so this is like a pre-prison kind of thing. And after the case, he actually went free.
So he was not guilty?
Mm-hmm. He was not guilty. Because it was based on the evidence that was there, hard to connect the dots that could actually lead to conclusion that this guy did that.
Oh, interesting. So there was evidence of a crime, but not sufficient evidence to prove that this person had committed that crime.
Mm-hmm. There were some things that could indicate it, but there was like no connection, like you said. And taking into consideration the time that this guy was already imprisoned, that was enough to say that, okay, for what we've got, that's totally enough. Now it's you don't need to be in prison anymore.
All right. So he may have still been convicted, but it was like, okay, lesser charge, time served, you're done.
Yeah, for some of the things. Yeah. For some of the things, actually. But eventually, he was supposed to spend 70 years in prison. 70. So that's quite a lot because there was lots of different charges. But for some of the charges, the most important ones, he was actually not charged. So eventually, he went free. And for minor things, he was charged.
Right. And yeah, it's interesting that making states' case is not easy. And ultimately, that's not a bad thing, that we actually have a legal system where you have to show incontrovertible evidence, especially when you talk about these huge charges. It does seem disproportionate. You know, what's the appropriate amount of time based on what really comes down to, I presume, a theft, that he did steal from someone a certain amount of money or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. There seems to be this practice of creating these extreme charges with these extreme sentencing rules as deterrent, so that you will think twice about doing it. Oh, I could go to jail for 20 years for running this hack.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that works, and I'm certainly no specialist in criminality, that those things actually serve as deterrents. I'm not asking for lesser charges or lesser cases and so forth, but it does seem like the courts still don't know how to grapple with the actual convictions around cybercrime.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. So they don't. And this was actually the first click fraud case that was happening at the time in the United States, and the first click fraud in general in the law. And that was the first case as well when hacker for such went free. So very interesting. And there's like a script that everybody can read, really. The guy's name was Fabio Gasparini.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very famous case in the court for the state of New York.
Interesting. And it's interesting. Yeah. So was they decided the crime had been committed in the U.S.?
So in general, so he was charged for like lots of things eventually. But because that was a new case in court, nobody kind of like, I don't want to say that directly, but there was a problem with dealing with it, you know, because it wasn't really defined in law.
Right.
So everybody was trying to interpret it, to what to do with it. And eventually our analysis was kind of crucial here.
Mm-hmm.
So the document that I was reading, for example, that was written by different government units at the time, because there was a certain evidence that has been gathered, already analyzed, and so on. So that kind of report wasn't just complete. And that actually raised lots of questions at the time, because one of those questions was, like, do we really, like, have everything that was, in general, like, used in this crime, let's say?
Right.
Do we have all of the evidence? What was the way that evidence was gathered? Was it a good way?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
You know what I mean, right?
Well, yeah.
So it could be a problem.
Without a doubt, yeah. And in law enforcement, they talk about this chain of evidence that you have to be very, you know, if you find the bloody knife on the ground at a crime scene, it's photographed in situ. It is, you're careful not to contaminate it, and you control the handling of that evidence till you can get to the trial very, very carefully. And I think that we don't think that way in technology about the cleanliness, and that there's no chance of being tampered or contaminated any step of the way. That's almost a foreign concept to us in technology. Very hard to prove that. And so you could easily disqualify evidence in the process just because you can decide that somebody may have edited that log file. How would we know?
Absolutely. Like you said, like when you find a knife, you don't grab it with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
So you secure it in a certain way, and the same story with technology.
Yes.
Like when you collect the evidence, it should be also secured. We've got to possibly luckily to do the backup, and the analysis in general should be happening by using different teams so that we've got a certain perspective on it.
Right.
And so on. Depends, of course, on the case and its importance, so to say. But eventually that should be the process. And we couldn't really find that practice applied in that case.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a trap. And Paula, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message.
Your users are working remotely, and the bad guys know it. New phishing attacks are already landing in the inboxes of your users. Are those machines as protected as they would be if they were on-prem? If their machine catches ransomware, how fast can you get it fixed? Don't be the IT admin who could have done something but didn't. Block the badness and prevent business continuity problems at the source by using Policy Pack on your remote work Windows 10 machines. With Policy Pack, you get the power to manage applications and browsers on Windows 10, overcome application UAC prompts, block unknownware, dynamically configure the Windows 10 start screen, taskbar, and file associations. As a bonus, you can use Policy Pack to deliver any real on-prem group policy and group policy preferences settings to your remote work machines for the security and configuration they need. Learn how thousands of other admins enhance their remote work scenarios. Come to policypack.com/remotework to learn more. That's policypack.com/remotework. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And listeners to this podcast are eligible to win a free copy of the Cybex Wiley book entitled MDM, Fundamental Security in the Modern Desktop, using Intune, Autopilot, and Azure to manage, deploy, and secure Windows 10 by Jeremy Moskowitz, Enterprise Mobility MVP. Simply pick Run As Radio in the dropdown when you visit policypack.com/remotework. Good luck, and we hope you win.
And we're back. It's Richard Campbell. This is Run As Radio, talking to my friend Paula. We're talking about, the business of hacking And for us on the good guy side, how do I make this business not pay? Like, what's the in the end, this makes most sense. Like, I always, I love the club analogy. I don't know that I even have the club in Poland, the little bar you put across your steering wheel just to make it harder to steal your car, right? I mean, it's that scenario of anybody really, really wants your car can get your car. They could cut the steering wheel apart. They can smash the club. But if you want a car, it's like, hey, that one's got a club. I'm not going to bother that car. I'll take the other car that doesn't have a club. And to me, it seems like a lot of securities like that. Let me just raise the bar enough that I'm not the easy target. I'm the hard target, so you don't bother. You're not going to make money off of me.
This is, of course, the approach that we see every day. But on the other hand, I would say that that's the kind of effectively everybody's approach.
Right.
Because it's really a matter of like skill set and the budget combined well. And out of that, we've got a really nice infrastructure security that comes out. But of course, when we like take these two variables and we work on them, that can end up differently in the various companies. So we can have companies that spend lots of money on their security systems, but eventually you get in and then you just basically manage to get access to that particular infrastructure within the first day.
Right.
And I'm thinking about one particular customer that we have over here, and they had like three anti-spam filters and a couple of other things inside, and isolation of the separate VLANs and so on. So, okay, great. But the implementation wasn't the greatest.
Right.
And there was nobody to verify on that. And on the other hand, you can have customer that is not very rich, but on the other hand, they are very creative. So you can see different implementations of variants of even built-in Windows solutions that are allowing us, for example, to stop processes that we don't know to communicate out from Windows operating system.
Right.
See, for example, Windows Firewall, which some people might be even laughing at and so on, because it was very simple in the past. Right now, it did not change, and we've got a possibility to configure certain rules for ports, or just say allow everything to go out and block whatever to go in and so on. So that's the simple use of it. But on the other hand, in Windows, you have a possibility to create rules that are per processes. And you can say that that process is allowed to communicate by all means or only on that port and so on. To simplify it, we could say by all means, and we've got a list of processes that are usually communicating over the network, and we only allow those. And anything else, it's not. So potentially, if we got ransomware in the form of a process won't be able to communicate out because it's blocked. And who stopped this? Simple Windows firewall.
Yes. What I like about this is not a technology solution per se. This is you understanding, as the person operating infrastructure for this organization, how your organization communicates. So you can put this very broad restriction in place. I know exactly what programs are allowed to communicate out of my network. Anything that isn't one of those programs doesn't get to do that. And ta-da, ransomware can't communicate outward.
Absolutely. That's like, I would say, the simplest, the easy to reach and easy to accomplish approach against ransomware. And sometimes we can complain that, oh, I don't have security budget and this and that. Well, that should rise creativity. And the customer that actually did that, because I'm thinking about the different customer, is actually a bank. And it's like a national bank.
Right.
So it's not really a commercial bank. So they have a decreased security budget. So they had to figure out what to do, and they figured this. And when I saw it, I was like, that's a very nice approach.
Very, yeah, effective. And again, now you trade this against your time for when other software is introduced that is legitimate and can't communicate, but should be able to raise a flag to you to say, this app's not able to communicate. Now you can choose, do I create a rule for the firewall? But if you're containing, if you've got a good control over what software is working on your network and how they're communicating, there's a large class. I mean, every kind of Trojan, like there's a whole bunch of malware that's broken if it can't communicate outward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, like I would love to see good development of malware We're always laughing at that in our team. Concept is great, yes. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when you look at the techniques, practices, and so on, you're like, that's not what we had at school.
Right. But it's all, you know, just thinking more creatively in general, because there are also network devices and things that are more sophisticated around this. They're just expensive and it takes time to learn how to use them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if you cannot afford them, then that could be one of the ways, of course, to do. And there's a huge portion of simplification that you mentioned, that when you decide to invest in software in cybersecurity field, whatever the field that will be inside cybersecurity, then it's really about simplification, monitoring, easier access to information, that you are informed in a certain way that you like, and you've got a possibility to customize it. Well, when you use the built-in Windows features, there's a lot of things that are fantastic right now in comparison to what we had in the past. But still, like, not always you may like have what you really want in terms of being informed.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's always, you know, the trade of software versus time here, both are valuable. You know, you're paid a salary. How much of your time can be put towards solving these security problems and, you know, mm-hmm. do the ROI on that? Does it make sense to pay for a contractor or a consultant to help you, or to buy certain products that will facilitate that so that you're spending less time? Although there's never no time. Anytime you introduce anything new, you have to help supervise the consultant. You have to learn the piece of software. Nothing's free here. There's a budget in terms of, you know, long term. Your firewall solution, if you do have software regularity induced to your network, means a constant overhead in providing new ports and communicating with your staff. That's a cost. Does that make sense then? You know, how do you weigh that off?
Absolutely. And there's lots of things that are building in the platform right now. For example, mm-hmm. within Windows 10, we've got something that I've been waiting for the past, I don't know, at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that's Exploit Guard. So in general, the possibility or lack of possibility right now to use different exploitation techniques over the platform. And that's so good, because a lot of people were complaining that, oh, firewall doesn't help me, antivirus doesn't help me. Of course, because antivirus focuses on two major ways of discovery. Yes. Yeah? So one's going to be the signature.
Right.
And another one's going to be the behavior. And the third one that is kind of like crawling a little bit, that's the machine learning, or in general, the intelligent threat detection. But before we implement that, there's going to be still lots of time that passes. So people mostly rely on the first two. So how, if we've got a vulnerability, let's say in the browser or in any other software, how can we discover that? With what? We don't have these tools. And in Windows right now, we've got an Exploit Guard that allows you to actually block that typical exploitation techniques that were used when there's a vulnerability in software.
So what does the Exploit Guard look like when it's in action?
Well, it's there aren't that many things that you can configure from the like first view perspective. Mm-hmm. But you've got in general possibility to decide which or what kind of applications can be sandboxed. And when you're trying to manipulate or access in general that particular process in a certain way to do something around it, to have certain function to do something around that process, for example, things like heap spray and so on, then eventually that behavior, it's recognized, mm-hmm. and that behavior is blocked. So it's a set of hundreds of known behaviors,
right,
that are predefined in Exploit Guard, that whenever there's a vulnerability in software, these vulnerabilities can be exploited usually this way, and these ways are already known. So that's why they're blocked.
Interesting. So there's not much for me to do as an IT person. If I have Windows Defender running on these Win 10 machines, it's Microsoft that's keeping that set of policies up to date and will essentially work automatically?
Yeah, pretty much. And the nice thing about that is that right now it's just building in a platform. So security of someone who is not really tech savvy, it's still maintained.
Right.
And that's what I really like about that approach. Of course, we could extend it by different monitoring options like Defender ATP, for mm-hmm. example, where you've got full monitoring of what's happening within the process and so on, that the process is communicating over the network and so on. But not everybody even wants to know that. So from the end user perspective, having that as a part of platform security, it's a really nice gain over here.
Yeah, no question. And you know, I'm thinking back to your story of your friend on Facebook, because Facebook normally, when it sees a login from somewhere else, will send you a message. You know, even if you haven't set up multi-factor authentication, it's like, hey, that's an unusual login. Was this you? And that by itself is a really interesting phenomenon. Like you and I used to travel enough that you often triggered those things. They would ask for additional credentials or even lock out, re-authenticate, please. Like there was, we're seeing more of this kind of exploit guard mindset that we're the products we use are building up a knowledge of our normal usage behavior. And when our usage behavior changes, they lock down a little.
Yeah, that's what also wonders, like, it makes me wonder really, like, why and how did it actually happen? So I didn't really ask that many questions because when you hear kind of like the stories like this, that was exactly my fault. Like, what about this? What about that? What about this? So I bet that, like, if you have to confirm within the email that this is you actually logging on, she might have done it.
Yeah, just said, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's me, yeah.
I've learned to just say okay to everything that pops up, right? So, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. And I think I actually might come out of this. And if I ask these questions, she would just feel more awkward, feel more awkward that she just did, I don't know, a very bad job. So I didn't want to put her in this situation. So, that's a different story.
Well, yeah, and it's tough to have a friend who's a security professional because, you know, you're always like, oh, I messed up in your profession again. I'm trying to be a better friend.
So I'm always happy to help, absolutely, but sometimes I prefer not to ask questions if they're not critical for me to solve something.
Right.
Because, you know, it's like if I was asking these questions to my grandma, she would be like, oh, just, I don't need you anymore. Yeah. I don't need your help.
I don't want this help. Well, you also have, you know, they're a friend. Are they asking you for help or they just want a pat on the shoulder? I feel your pain. You know, it's going to be okay. You'll figure this out. Like, yeah, sometimes people don't actually want the help, right? They're just asking for a little support.
Right. So I think it's both eventually.
Right. But it's got to be tough when you're in the business and your friends are like, and you're like, oh no, I mean, I am not in the business. I get to hang around with cool people like you, but I am certainly an advocate for password managers and MFA and enjoying my YubiKeys and just trying to be a good example. You know, I do have friends now who are technically savvy, but not professional technology folks who are like, you really are happy with those YubiKeys. I'm thinking I should get some. And we talk it for a while. And you know, rule number one, you never own one YubiKey, at least two, and sort of working through those things. And they're starting to do it. Then maybe I'm making a positive impact here.
Right. But on the other hand, it's just becoming more difficult.
Yes.
And people don't know how to start. That's why they don't even start.
Yeah.
And that's where it actually takes us to, that they got these situations like my friend on Facebook.
And so it's great that we can sort of help lead folks down the path here. But this is how we make this business of hacking go away, is that we get better and it just gets more expensive for them. And they, in the end, it's not profitable.
That's true.
I hope so. I hope that's true. Well, Paula, I would say what's next for you? Where are we going to see you? But I suspect you're staying home just like the rest of us.
Yes, I'm staying home right now. And, It's great. So finally, after so many years of travel, that's basically what our team does.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, it's staying at home. So, it also raises a couple of more questions that are related with remote work and cybersecurity. And that's another interesting subject here.
Yeah, no question. And of course, Secure is bigger and busier than ever, right? Because it's not like cybersecurity is going away. It's only getting larger.
Yes, that's true. And nice fact about us is that we have actually encountered during the pandemic time really huge growth in projects. And we did not really expect that. We have to hire one person. We are still open for new employees because cybersecurity, as you mentioned, it's a very, very booming subject.
Great question. Paula, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Great to talk to you again. I'm glad you're well.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And always great to hear from you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.